Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 904, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This is being recorded on May 5th of the year 2016. As the title of the program indicates, rather than adhering to one particular path of inquiry or subject, what we're going to be doing in this program is something of a potpourri. We are going to be, in some cases, introducing new material. In just about all cases, however, we are either supplementing and or bringing up to date information and paths of inquiry and research that we have dealt with in past programs. In, among other shows, For the Record 791, we took a look at the escape of Adolf Hitler. It has now been scientifically established that the corpse or corpses produced by Adolf, produced that were allegedly of Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun or not Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun. There has been what Winston Churchill referred to as the bodyguard of lies that has been generated surrounding the escape of Adolf Hitler. In the book Grey Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler by Simon Dunstan, D-U-N-S-T-A-N, and Gerard Williams, W-I-L-L-I-A-M-S, that was the foundation for the book, for the show, I should say, For the Record 791. The thesis was proposed that not only did Hitler escape, but that the escape was a gambit arranged between Alan Dulles, who was head of the Bern, Switzerland OSS office and also was deeply involved with American support for Nazi industry, courtesy of the Sullivan and Cromwell Wall Street law firm, along with his brother, John Foster Dulles, and the other person arranging this escape on behalf of the Third Reich was Martin Bormann. The goal was to assure Hitler's escape and, from the standpoint of the West, to save the art treasures that Hitler had amassed and the Third Reich had amassed from destruction. This would have erased much of the cultural history of the West, and perhaps even more importantly, the participation of key Third Reich scientists, many of them war criminals of the First Order, in U.S. industry under Project Paperclip was guaranteed. I suspect that although this was not mentioned directly in the book, The Grey Wolf, or Grey Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler, that the incorporation of the Reinhard-Gehlen Nazi spy outfit into U.S. intel was also part of the deal. One of the things that we noted in For the Record 791 is that even decades later, many files on both sides of the Atlantic about Hitler pertaining to Hitler's whereabouts in the late 1940s are still classified. From the book Grey Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler by Simon Dunstan and Gerard Williams, we read, during this period, the late 1940s, the FBI was taking reports of Hitler being in Latin America very seriously. Thousands of documents pertaining to Hitler from these years are still classified as top secret on both sides of the Atlantic, nevertheless, and despite the very heavy censorship of the few files released into the public domain, some information can be gleaned. Well, we noted at that time, that is to say, in the For the Record 791, recorded 2 years ago in May of 2014, why would documents pertaining to someone who supposedly committed suicide 70-plus years ago, or almost 70 years ago at that time, now more than 70 years ago, why would they still be classified years or decades later. And beyond that, even more importantly, as we are now about to read, the publication of this book, which has been supplemented by a History Channel documentary. I believe this History Channel, it might be HBO. I think it is the History Channel, called Hunting Hitler, has given publicity to the book Grey Wolf. Why would some of the people connected with this book, and why would the authors be receiving death threats for talking about someone who supposedly committed suicide 70 years ago? From the Wales Online blog, that's W-A-L-E-S, of course, part of the UK. From Wales Online of March 21st of 2013, death threats for Hitler book author Gerard Williams. A South Wales author who has sensationally claimed that Adolf Hitler escaped the bunker to live in Argentina, says he and his research team have received death threats. Skipping down. The book also claims Hitler's escape was carried out with the blessings of the U.S. authorities, who wanted rocket secrets and details of where priceless art treasures were hidden. Yesterday, Swansea, that's S-W-A-N-S-E-A, born Williams, who grew up in Coychurch, Bridge End, said, quote, "We have ruffled some very big feathers. Traditional historians don't like it, and certain governments don't like it. We have had some death threats already," unquote. Well, again, as with the continued classification of documents pertaining to Hitler's whereabouts in the late 1940s, top secret, why would death threats be directed at the author of a book that has been dismissed by mainstream media as, you know, fantastic conspiracy theory, nonsense, what have you? Why would the authors be getting death threats for writing about someone who supposedly committed suicide 70 years ago? That in and of itself does not make sense. And if in and of itself the book were the nonsense that it is supposed to be, then the necessity of delivering death threats would certainly appear to be altogether superfluous. So again, why are the authors of Grey Wolf getting death threats? Why are documents pertaining to Hitler's whereabouts in the late 1940s, this for someone who supposedly killed himself in 1945, why are they still classified, and why are the authors of Grey Wolf getting death threats? Again, a question that I think more or less answers itself. Obviously, they are getting death threats, and obviously the documents are still classified to a large extent because the documents contain sensitive information, and the authors have disclosed something that they are not supposed to disclose. As Williams put it, "We have ruffled some very big feathers." By the way, the official version, as we spoke about in For the Record 864, visiting with the brilliant Peter Lavenda, the official version of the death of Adolf Hitler, written by Sir Hugh Trevor Roper, was actually a British intelligence operation. It was a PSYOP. It was called Operation Nursery, and it was designed to counteract accounts that Hitler had in fact escaped and had done so with the connivance of the West. The actual official version of Hitler's death was an early gambit in the Cold War. Another subject that we have been talking about is the installation of the BJP government of Narendra Modi in India. That installation, or quote, election, accomplished in part through the support of Pierre Omidyar, the linchpin or the kingpin of eBay, and someone who had helped to finance the Maidan coup in Ukraine that brought the OUNB fascists back to power in Ukraine. The BJP party of Narendra Modi is essentially a political cat's paw for the RSS. That is a Hindu nationalist slash fascist political party, one of whose alumni assassinated Mahatma Gandhi. We noted that when Modi came to the Silicon Valley, all of the kingpins of the Silicon Valley, notably Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, were oozing all over Narendra Modi, who was playing it very cool and very hip, clasping his hands together and bowing for the audience, doing the namaste dance, so to speak. And in general, the mavens of high tech were just oozing all over Narendra Modi, and so all outward appearances were very much taken with his situation. A lot of that, of course, is that they are hoping to generate a lot of business in the world's second most populous country, which is, of course, India. The fact that Narendra Modi is essentially installing or has presided over what is, for all intents and purposes, a Hindu nationalist slash fascist government was of no consequence to these people. And indeed, in the case of Pierre Omidyar, that would be, to a certain extent, business as usual. He helped to finance the Ukrainian coup, which saw the return to power of the heirs of the OUNB in Ukraine. And Narendra Modi has basically been, I guess you could say, staying in costume for all of his genuflection at in the presence of the Silicon Valley high rollers. He is basically adhering to the standard RSS slash BJP playbook. India is turning very repressive toward Muslims and toward political dissidents of all kinds, including and especially those who will stand up for the Muslim minority in India. And contrasting the unctuous behavior of the Silicon Valley maidens in the presence of Narendra Modi with his current behavior, consider the following. I wonder whether Mark Zuckerberg or any of the rest of these obsequious creatures would agree with this. Of course, they're not going to protest against it because they're not going to risk their business prospects in India. From the Indian Express of February 23rd of 2016, now government cyber cell to counter, quote, negative, unquote, news. This by Amitay, Amitay, Ranjan, Ranjan. It reads, the government plans to set up a special media cell to track content online and counter news and comments that it decides are negative or provocative. Last month, the National Security Council Secretariat, or NSCS, proposed that a National Media Analytics Center, or NMAC, be created to store, monitor, and analyze round-the-clock blogs, web portals of TV channels, and newspapers, as well as social media platforms such as Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube, among others. The government will keep a watch on the narrative in all such threads. Every time a negative narrative surfaces, a possible counter would be initiated through press releases, briefings, or press conferences, depending on the intensity or standing of the post, said sources. Last August, the government had directed all ministries to set up quick response teams comprising senior ministry officials, nodal officers from the Press Information Bureau, and independent experts to defend its case in the face of negative news. Sources said that the NMAC proposal is based on tracking software designed, and I'm not going to attempt to pronounce this gentleman's name, or maybe it's a female, PONNURANGAMKUMARAGURU, an assistant professor at Delhi-based Indraprastha Institute of Information Technology. That's IMDRAPRASTHA. Continuing. The software will generate relevant tags to highlight, quote, belligerent, unquote, comments or social media chats, they added. At a deeper level, the software would comb posts and comments to classify them into negative, neutral, and positive categories while highlighting relevant text, sources said. It will also show up if a negative posting was factually correct or, quote, an intentional canard, unquote, they said. Quote, the software will also help recall the past pattern of the writer to check the number of times he took a negative or positive stand, his background, and preferences of websites and areas of interest to judge whether they were aimed at fomenting trouble or radicalization, said sources. They said the objective is to come up with instant counters, unquote, on social media to plug resentment triggered by news items so that personal opinions do not snowball into public protests and threaten law and order. I think that speaks for itself, and it presents a dramatic and, under the circumstances, grotesque contrast with the, again, unctuous, sycophantic behavior of the mavens of Silicon Valley, Mark Zuckerberg et al., who were oozing all over Narendra Modi when he made an appearance here in the Valley, and he in turn was oozing all over them. I know that in the picture he had something of the photograph of him, you know, bowing, clasping his hands together. Again, doing the namaste dance, so to speak. He had this sort of Cheshire Cat smile on his face, and I think I know why, because he does not stand for the free communication of online information that all of these full libertarians would have us believe they do. That is to say, the kingpins of Silicon Valley. Again, note that the Modi government is actually not only monitoring, but generating counters to any bad publicity online. That, I think, is also very sadly in keeping with the types of governments that Pierre Omidyar has promoted in Ukraine. It is not only illegal to criticize the OUNB of Stefan Bandera or its military arm, the UPA, founded by Roman Shukievich, but the Institute for National Memory that is presided over by Volodymyr Vyatrovich is currently rewriting Ukrainian history in a pro-Nazi, pro-Axis fashion, completely whitewashing the activities of the OUNB and UPA.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Back to India, again, another of the ascension of whose government was assisted by Pierre Omidyar, as we have seen in, For the Record, 795, among others. The Hindu nationalist slash fascist government of Narendra Modi is not just monitoring and counteracting bad online press, but is also taking a brutal physical hand against, or manifesting a brutal physical hand against student protesters of the RSS/BJP government. Again, this should come as no surprise from Z, that's Z as in zebra, double E, news of February 1st of 2016. Instead of listening, Modi government brutally beating students for protesting against RSS, and that of Rahul Gandhi, G-A-N-D-H-R, a member of parliament. Even as Delhi police on Monday faced widespread criticism over a video clip that shows the alleged assault on the students by male constables and some men who are not in uniform, Congress Vice President Rahul Gandhi said that instead of listening to students, the Modi government was brutally beating them up. And his tweet, shocking attack on students. Instead of listening to them, now the Modi government is brutally beating them up for protesting against the RSS, Rahul said. In the short video clip, a constable is seen dragging a female protester by her hair and pushing her down. A youth is also seen being bashed. Two journalists who have alleged that they were beaten up and their cameras smashed while covering the protest claimed that the police action was unprovoked, as per PTI. The clip has gone viral on various social media sites. Meanwhile, Chief Minister Arvind, A-R-V-I-N-D, Kejriwal, that's K-E-J as in John, R-I-W-A-L, today hit out at Delhi police alleging that it was being used as the RSS and BJP's private army, unquote, under a political dispensation that is at war with students across the country. And I would note that some of the attackers were constables and others were people who were out of uniform. And they were the ones who were beating up students and apparently also roughing up journalists who were noting what was going on. Again, this really is in keeping with what Modi has been doing. Critics of government are writers and people who value free speech, in particular those who have been speaking out against the persecution of India's very sizable Muslim minority, have been threatened or in some cases apparently killed as well. And again, things are going very badly indeed for the Muslim minority in India. In For the Record, 896 through 899, we revisited Farah Mansour's heroic research talking about how the Khomeini government in Iran actually came to power via a covert operation on behalf or executed by the Bush, George H.W. Bush faction of the CIA. That covert action was designed to not only destabilize Jimmy Carter and assure his election defeat, but also to install an anti-government or an anti-Soviet, anti-communist government on the southern flank of the former Soviet Union. Again, a detailed description of that in For the Records 896, 897, 898, 899. Descriptions and audio files for those shows. Supplementing that and including some information that we have looked at in past broadcasts, the Khomeini government itself was the outgrowth of a Shia Muslim sect called the Devotees of Islam that was affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood. Most of the Muslim Brotherhood is Sunni Islam and is actually violently opposed to the Shia section or segment of the Muslim faith. That is not, however, true of the Devotees of Islam, with which Ayatollah Khomeini was affiliated. In an article called Cold War, Holy Warrior by Robert Dreyfus, D-R-E-Y-F-U-S-S, from Mother Jones magazine of January and February of 2006. We read, the regime of the Ayatollahs in Iran grew out of a secret society called the Devotees of Islam, a Muslim Brotherhood affiliate whose leader in the 1950s was the mentor of Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. And as we have looked at in For the Record 352, Khomeini's exile stay in Paris, part of his exile from Iran, was financed by François Janoux. A very important fellow we have spoken about. He was the primary force behind the Bank al-Taqwa and also was the heir to the collected literary works and political last will and testament of Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels. And again, just go to the SpitfireList.com website to open quote François, F-R-A-N-C-O-I-S, Genoud, capital G-E-N-O-U-D, close quote, and you can read all about it. An interesting article concerns the people with whom Justice Antonin Scalia spent his last hours. Scalia passed away at the age of 79 earlier this year in Texas. That death and the naming of a replacement for Scalia has been the focal point of huge controversy. The Republican Party has flat out refused to even have hearings, let alone seat President Obama's selection to replace Antonin Scalia.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
There has been a fair amount of conspiracy online discussion of Scalia having been murdered. Now, that presumably was done by the evil Barack Obama so he could name a replacement, blah, 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 blah. While I can't rule it out, I do rule out that Obama would have had him murdered. I doubt that he was killed. The online conspiracy fertilizer has had it that he was found with a pillow over his face having been smothered. If, in fact, Antonin Scalia had been a victim of foul play, I think it is highly unlikely he would have still had a pillow over his face. I think it is highly unlikely that his assassins would have even used such a crude methodology. There are any number of toxins that will kill someone very effectively and be absolutely undetectable afterwards. I do not want to be misunderstood as claiming that Scalia was murdered. If, in fact, he was, as some are claiming, I think it would have been more likely that the killing was intended to keep the Republican Party in line with whatever extremist they had decided to nominate for president in 2016. In the event, it was Donald Trump. I think as foul as Donald Trump is, and he is a fascist with a capital F, he really has had something of a bad rap in this sense. Again, I have no use for Donald Trump, as I have indicated in the past. However, Donald Trump is simply coming out and saying out loud what the rest of the Republican Party and their constituency secretly believes. It's just that in the past, the GOP has used dog whistles, and now Trump is coming right out and going, yakety, 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 yak. And so everybody's going, oh, how shocking. We're shocked, shocked to learn that there's gambling going on in this establishment. Really, as I said in For the Record 894, for the GOP and others who are shocked, the Trump candidacy is your winnings, sir. And so if there was any foul play behind Scalia's death, which I don't believe, he was 79, I can't rule it out, then that, I think, would have been the goal, to keep the GOP in line no matter what sort of Doberman Pinscher or other breed of attack dog the Republicans nominated for president in 2016. What is, however, quite interesting is with whom Antonin Scalia has been networking. He was, at the time of his death, at a ranch in Texas and was schmoozing and hanging out with an international order of knights dating back to the 17th century. And the head of that order of knights, the International Order of St. Hubertus, H-U-B-E-R-T-U-S, was the Archduke of Austria, a member of the Habsburg family. With the Habsburgs, of course, were the ruling family of the Austro-Hungarian Empire for 600 years. Karl von Habsburg heads up the UNPO, a non-governmental organization that basically is looking to break larger states up into smaller ethnic entities that can then be controlled either by corporations or folded into a larger fascist consortium. Von Habsburg was married at one point to Francesca Thyssen-Bornemisza, the Thyssen-Bornemisza family, being part of the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flat Capital Network. And as we have looked at, the Habsburgs were also deeply involved with the OUNB heirs in Ukraine. Much of what is now Ukraine was formerly part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, including and especially Galicia or Western Ukraine. So, again, I think it is interesting and more than a little significant that Antonin Scalia has been networking with the Habsburg milieu. From the Washington Post of February 24th of 2016, Justice Scalia spent his last hours with members of this secret society of elite hunters. This by Amy Britton, B-R-T-T-A-I-N, and Sari, S-A-R-I, Horwitz, H-O-R-W-I-T-Z. Again, from the Washington Post of February 24th of 2016. This reads in part, when Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia died 12 days ago at the West Texas Ranch, he was among high-ranking members of an exclusive fraternity for hunters called the International Order of St. Hubertus, an Austrian society that dates back to the 1600s. After Scalia's death on February 13th, the names of the 35 other guests at the remote resort, along with details about Scalia's connection to the hunters, have remained largely unknown. A review of public records shows that some of the men who were with Scalia at the ranch are connected through the International Order of St. Hubertus, whose members gathered at least once before at the same ranch for a celebratory weekend. Members of the worldwide male-only society wear dark green robes emblazoned with a large cross and the motto, and I'm not going to try the Latin, which means honoring God by honoring his creatures, unquote, according to the group's website. I guess this is a hunting society honoring God. It should be really honoring God by killing his creatures. Perhaps that extends to members of the human or human animals as well, given the past inclinations of not only the Habsburgs, but also those elements of the Habsburg dynasty that are affiliated with the Underground Reich. Skipping down. And again, these are the people that were hanging out with Scalia at that ranch. The International Order of St. Hubertus, according to its website, is a, quote, true knightly order in the historical tradition, unquote. In 1695, Count Franz Anton von Spork founded the society in Bohemia, which is in the modern-day Czech Republic. Listen to this. The group's grand master is, quote, His Imperial Highness István from Habsburg-Lothringen, the Archduke of Austria, unquote, according to the order's website. Skipping down again. The Society's U.S. chapter launched in 1966 at the famous Bohemian Club in San Francisco, which is associated with the all-male Bohemian Grove, one of the most well-known secret societies in the country. So again, whether or not Scalia was killed, and I doubt it, I will guarantee you if there's anything to that, he would not have been smothered with a pillow still over his face. That is just plain drivel. That belongs in the same category as the controlled demolition of the World Trade Center. It is fresh fertilizer. Put it on your garden when it stops smelling, and it will make your garden grow very nicely. However, if he was killed, I think it would have been to keep the Republicans in line so that they would march in lockstep behind whatever monster the Republicans had nominated in 2016. And as it is, that monster is none other than Donald Trump. So we will see if the Trumpfenkampfverbande winds up staying in lockstep. Troops of Form has claimed that Obama, that the Republican Party should stonewall Scalia's replacement. There is something of an aside. There is a canard that has been bandied around, largely on the, quote, left, unquote, that there is no difference between the Republicans and Democrats. Well, that is actually not true. There may not be as much difference as some people would like, but with things like global warming and the attitude toward climate change, among other things, there is a huge difference. And the most, well, probably second only to the attitude toward climate change, the federal judicial appointments, not just the Supreme Court, but all of the federal judicial appointments, federal judges are appointed and they serve for life. That is the single most important thing that any president does. And there have been huge, huge differences between the Supreme Court justices and other federal judges appointed by relatively conservative Democrats, such as, for example, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, and the sorts of creatures that have been appointed by Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, or Ronald Reagan or George Bush. Antonin Scalia, for example, was one of the very worst. One of his rulings, he ruled that it was okay for a court to go ahead and execute a man who had been condemned to death, even if information surfaced that the man was innocent after his conviction. That is very, 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 quote, interesting, unquote. It is, of course, utterly brutal and, for those who don't think there is any difference between the Republicans and Democrats, I just have to say the old street adage, check yourself. Again, Antonin Scalia ruled that it was okay for a court to go ahead and proceed with the execution of a man who had been condemned to death, even though information had come to light after his conviction that he was, in fact, innocent. That is special, and that is more than a little indicative of the difference between Republicans and Democrats. When you do what I do, you have to get accustomed to being unpopular, frankly. And with regard to the adventures of Eddie the Friendly Spook, that being Eddie Snowden, I think, done a body of work as good as any as I have ever done. And yet, attacking Snowden or viewing Snowden as a negative creature, and he, in fact, sucks big time, is not popular at all. As we have seen in many of our shows, the affair Snowden was part and parcel to the Maidan coup and the deep sixing of Barack Obama's reboot or attempted reboot with Russia. And I am very, very, very supportive of the Russian position vis-a-vis Ukraine. And by the same token, I am very, very supportive, though not unqualifiedly so, of the NSA with regard to L'Affaire Snowden. Part of the reason for the latter is that we have proceeded into an entirely new phase of civilization, with the weakification of society, with the growth of mobile technology and social media. We are quite literally in a new phase of civilization, and yet human nature has not changed at all. We are still the same femur-cracking, marrow-sucking Neanderthals we have always been, and that bodes very poorly for the future. One of the reasons I am so supportive of NSA vis-a-vis Snowden, and remember that most of what Snowden talked about, the vast bulk of it, and the things that everybody was shocked about, have been public record for about 20 years. I have spoken about them intermittently from open sources for about 20 years. So there's no reason for anybody to be, quote, shocked, and yet they are shocked. The reason why I support NSA vis-a-vis the Snowden op is that there are things that either can happen or may have happened that I think really only the NSA, being a military agency, could potentially deal with. This is not to say that NSA will deal successfully with it. I don't know. I don't know what goes on past the point beyond the locked steel gates of Spy City. But, for example, with regard to the recent alleged hacking by Iran of a dam facility in New York and other things, with the potential to hack and bring down a nuclear power plant, things that would be absolutely catastrophic if they were allowed to come to fruition, and which would have to be dealt with very quickly and very decisively. I frankly think that only a military agency would at least have the potential to act appropriately in those circumstances. Certainly one could not have a civilian bureaucracy hemming and hawing and beating around the bush when, in fact, no pun intended, when, in fact, a chemical plant or a nuclear power plant or a dam or something else was being hacked. Cyberterrorism also has the extremely distasteful it is something that there has been a lot of discussion about, quote, false flag operations. Well, a skilled hacker or skilled hackers, plural, can very easily mask their true affiliation. So the possibility for a false flag mass casualty cyber terrorist act is enormous. And I think that an agency like NSA, acting in concert with other appropriately equipped cyber-capable agencies, is the best hope for averting an absolutely monstrous event. And indicative of the kinds of things that are going on and that offer the potential for mayhem beyond comprehension, from of all publications, Maxim, M-A-X-I-M, a magazine from December 10th of 2015, an article by Steve Huff, H-U-F-F. A Boston subway train just went rogue. Subheaded, hack, ghost conductor, whatever it was, something really weird happened on the Red Line. This reads in part, imagine you're on a subway train near the front and perhaps you can see into the operator's cab. It's empty, but the train starts moving anyway and it doesn't stop. It's a creepy scenario, and it happened early Thursday on Boston's Red Line train, which left the Braintree station just after 6 a.m. without an operator. According to a statement released by the Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority, or MBTA, the train ran without stopping until it was just north of the North Quincy station, where MBTA staff managed to stop the train by switching off the electrified third rail. Frank DePaola, general manager of the MBTA, said the incident was, quote, highly troubling, unquote, and, quote, under investigation by transit police detectives, unquote. Well, again, I don't know. What happened here? Was it a hack? Who knows? But it was definitely something weird. Well, who are you going to call? Ghostbusters? I don't think so. One would hope that NSA and other appropriately equipped and associated government agencies will be able to deal with something like this. I don't know if they can. I know who won't be able to deal with it. Sure as bloody hell won't be the ACLU. It won't be Amy Goodman or Pacifica Radio or goddamn Glenn Greenwald or any of these creatures. Let's hope NSA can deal with it. It won't be Ghostbusters. More along the same lines from the NextGov.com blog of March 24th of 2016. Hacktivists mess with chemicals in water treatment plant. Reason part, talk about your doomsday scenario. Hackers infiltrated a water's utility control system and changed the levels of chemicals being used to treat tap water, according to Verizon Security Solutions. Verizon describes the attack against the Chemuri, K-E-M-U-R-I, water company, a pseudonym for a real firm in an unspecified country, in this month's IT security breach report. A hacktivist group with ties to Syria compromised Chemuri's computers after exploiting unpatched web vulnerabilities in a payment portal that was connected to the public internet. The hack, which involved SQL injection and phishing, was made easier because login credentials for the operational control system were stored on the web server. So again, who exactly did that? That is an example of the kinds of things, the kind of potential mayhem that, it scares the water out of me. And I don't see who the hell could possibly keep things in the baselines other than NSA and, again, other associated and cyber-capable agencies. It's one of the reasons why I am so supportive, though not unqualifiedly supportive, of NSA vis-a-vis Snowden. The last thing that we frankly need is a compromised and consequently incapable NSA. And again, if you want to be unpopular, be supportive of the NSA vis-a-vis Snowden, and I am, and be supportive of Russia vis-a-vis Ukraine, and I am that too. Not a way to make friends, but frankly, altogether right in both cases.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Keeping up with what our online community or online world is capable of producing, reviewing ever so briefly from information that we looked at in For the Record 901 from Vice Motherboard of March 27th of 2016 by Lorenzo Franceschi Bicchirai. That's FranceschiHyphen BiCHIRAI. A hacker made thousands of internet-connected printers spit out racist flyers. And this is a guy named Andrew Auernheimer, A-U-E-R-N-H-E-I-M-E-R, who also uses the name Weave, W-E-E-V. He is a master hacker and a very accomplished internet soldier of fortune. He is also a Nazi and one of Citizen Glenn Greenwald's many Nazi associates. Again, we looked at that in, for the record, 901, and for the record, we took a look at the Auernheimer Greenwald Association, and for the record, 888 as well. Also from For the Record, 901, and again, we are coming into a whole new phase of civilization. Article in the Ars, A-R-S, Technica, T-E-C-H-M-I-C-A, blog of March 24th of 2016 by Peter Bright, B-R-I-G-H-T. Microsoft terminates its Tay AI chatbot after she turns into a Nazi. And this is about, an artificial intelligence chatbot nicknamed Tay that was put together by Microsoft to interact with people on Twitter. And as one commenter noted, Tay went from humans are super cool to full Nazi in less than 24 hours, and I'm not at all concerned about the future of artificial intelligence. Obviously, they're being sarcastic there. That is exactly what happened. The chatbot learns from interacting with listeners. It went from being, again, normal slash way cool to being a full-blown Nazi artificial intelligence chatbot in less than 24 hours. People should beware of what is coming. In that regard, and again, referencing my thoughts vis-a-vis NSA and the importance of having an agency that can react to things that were frankly unimaginable even a short time ago. From the New York Times of March 25th, 2015, an article by John Markoff, M-A-R-K-O-F-F, and Steve Lohr, L-O-H-R, "The race is on to control artificial intelligence and tech's future," it reads in part. "The resounding win by a Google artificial intelligence program over a champion in the complex board game Go this month was a statement, not so much to professional game players as to Google's competitors. Many of the tech industry's biggest companies like Amazon, Google, IBM, and Microsoft are jockeying to become the go-to company for artificial intelligence. In the industry's lingo, the companies are engaged in a platform war," unquote. A platform in technology is essentially a piece of software that other companies build on and that consumers cannot do without. Become the platform, and huge profits will follow. Microsoft dominated personal computers because its Windows software became the center of the consumer software world. Google has come to dominate the internet through its ubiquitous search bar. If true believers in artificial intelligence are correct that this long-promised technology is ready for the mainstream, the company that controls AI could steer the tech industry for years to come. And again, all I can say is watch out. You know, watch out for this, because human beings have not changed at all. Just remember Emery's first principle. Most people are a-holes, and that's why the world is so full of S blank blank blank. You want an artificial intelligence? Well, it will ultimately learn from human beings. And all I can say is, watch the hell out. It is not going to be good. And, of course, these things like airplanes, like cars, which are running on computers, various aspects of the Internet of Things, there will be hacking going on. And perhaps the AIs themselves will be doing the hacking. Who knows? And maybe they will be Nazi AIs. I don't know. But I'm telling you, as blues singer Taj Mahal said, man, if you ain't scared, you ain't right. And I, for one, am scared. and other things are going to be very interesting. There has been a lot of discussion both by Donald Trump and by Bernie Sanders about how to stop the hemorrhaging of jobs to the third world. I think a lot of their bloviating, both Trump and Bernie Sanders, frankly, have been waxing demagogic. Certainly, I don't like the hemorrhaging of jobs, but how much a president can do about it remains to be seen, because a lot of this is being done not only by transnational corporations, but is being done under treaties like NAFTA and GATT that were ratified by other countries, and attempting to neutralize those unilaterally will very likely result in a trade war or trade wars. Now, again, I think something would be great if something could be done about it. How much can be done about it and how that would be done remains to be seen. And I think both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are guilty of gross oversimplification and, frankly, a facile rhetorical and ideological approach to that. As understandable as the viewpoint is, the question is how to do it. And both, I think, have been dangerously simplistic in how they are proposed to do it. Both of them have also overlooked something else, and that is not just jobs, not just that jobs will be lost to third world countries paying pittance for wages, but also to robots. From Market Watch of February 23rd of 2016, this by Steve Goldstein, the robots are coming for jobs that pay $20 an hour or less, White House finds. It's intuitive that automation will take low-wage jobs, but the White House, in its annual economic report of the president, has broken down just how much that is so. There's an 83% chance that automation will take a job with an hourly wage below $20, a 31% chance that automation will take a job with an hourly wage between $20 and $40, and just a 4% chance that automation will take a job with an hourly wage above $40. And also, from Equipment World by Wayne Grayson, the Equipment World of January 25th of this year, 2016, an article by Wayne Grayson, G-R-A-Y-S-O-N. AI and robotics expected to claim nearly 500,000 construction jobs by 2020. An estimated 5.1 million jobs are expected to be lost in the next 5 years due to advances in technology, specifically those in artificial intelligence, machine learning, 3D printing, and robotics, according to a report from the World Economic Forum. Of those job losses, construction and extraction are anticipated to account for nearly 10%. And that will be very, very interesting indeed. It notes, quote, even jobs that will shrink in number are simultaneously undergoing change in the skill sets required to do them. Across nearly all industries, the impact of technological and other changes is shortening the shelf life of employees' existing skill sets. So, obviously, upgrading the training and education of workers is one thing to do. Who will foot the bill for that is another consideration altogether. But again, with regard to the great leap forward in our technologies, all I can say is, watch out. We're still the same femur-cracking, marrow-sucking Neanderthals we have always been. But now, things are really going to get interesting. This concludes For the Record program number 904, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This is being recorded on May 5th of 2016. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.